Once upon a time, in a far-off corner of the decaying Russian Empire, a local nobleman brought home a curiosity. She was extraordinarily tall, around 6'6", over 2 meters, athletic, dark-skinned, and completely covered in red hair. She refused to wear clothes, even in the winter. She always slept outside, even when offered a bed, often sleeping among the wild water buffalo in a pond on the nobleman's estate. She spent her days swimming in the river, racing against the nobleman's horses, and often winning, playing with stones, eating fruit from the trees, and drinking alcohol. She never learned to speak, only grunting, screaming, and laughing. However, she reportedly could understand and follow directions. Sometime in the mid-19th century, this creature had been captured in the forest, on the southern foothills of the Caucasus Mountains, by a traveling merchant. The merchant had spotted her among the trees, but she disappeared into the brush before he could call out. A few days later, the merchant returned with a pack of hounds and managed to brutalize, subdue, and capture her. She was shackled and held in a ditch, surrounded by sharp wooden stakes, before being sold to a few different owners. Eventually, Edgy Ganaba, an Abkhaz nobleman, purchased her and brought her back to his estate in Tkina, a remote village in eastern Abkhazia. She was named Zana, possibly derived from the Georgian Zangi, meaning black. Initially, she was confined to a stone enclosure where she slept in a hole and ate food thrown over the wall to her. As she became less aggressive, she was upgraded to a nicer enclosure and eventually was set free to roam Ganaba's land. She was tormented by the local children and given menial labor to do for nothing in exchange. Under circumstances that are unclear, but certainly horrifying regardless of the details, she had at least 4 children with local men. It's been said that there were 5, but Zana drowned the first one, and so the subsequent 4 children were taken from her. She had 2 daughters, Janda and Gamasa, and 2 sons, Kodzanar and Kuit. The 2 youngest children, Gamasa and Kuit, were raised by Ganaba's wife and lived into their 60s or 70s, with Kuit dying in 1954. Zana lived in Tkina until her death, around the early 1880s or 1890s, having never shown any signs of aging. The story you've just heard is an amalgamation of local legends and hearsay collected by Russian zoologist Alexander Mashdovtsev and a young Boris Poshnev, the latter of whom would later become a founding father of Russian cryptozoology. Mashdovtsev and Poshnev traveled to Tkina in the early 1960s and interviewed locals who claimed to remember Zana, including several alleged supercentenarians. How much of it is true? We'll never know. Basically, everyone took it for granted that Zana was an Abneu, or Almasti, the Caucasian and Turkic variant of the widespread wild man folkloric creature, known elsewhere as Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or Yeti, among many other names. Abkhazia, like the Caucasus as a whole, is filled to the brim with wild man lore. Wild man folklore tends to pop up in heavily forested and mountainous regions, probably owing to the presence of large mammals like bears, historic tensions between settled societies and hunter-gatherers, and the inherent mystery of the vast wilderness. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jalabi the Durian, Sluds the Shoggoth, and Huslino the Capybara, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Ever wondered why so many empires' borders end around here? It's because of the Caucasus Mountains, Few empires have ever been able to conquer them, and none, except perhaps the Soviet Union, have ever managed to truly take control of the peoples therein. The Caucasus has always been viewed as mysterious, exotic, and mildly terrifying by the Russian intelligentsia and elite. It's one of the most ethnically, religiously, and linguistically diverse regions on Earth, with three primary language families, unrelated to any other family, found only in this area. Abkhazia, northwest of Georgia, is a weird place in a weird region. By the mid-19th century, Abkhazia and all of its neighboring regions were part of the Russian Empire, but still had many cultural remnants of Ottoman influence and local folk culture. With its semi-tropical climate, soaring mountains, dense forests, and Black Sea beaches, Abkhazia was something of a tourist hotspot for European royalty and nobility, and it remained such throughout the Soviet period. It's still a popular vacation spot for Russian tourists today, because Russians are one of the only nationalities that can reliably visit. That's because since 1993, Abkhazia has been a de facto independent, breakaway state from Georgia, which it's internationally recognized as part of. It's one of those countries that are only sort of countries. Abkhazia is heavily reliant on Russia, much like its even weirder and more isolated sister state, South Ossetia, which is for another video. Abkhazia is unusually diverse even for the Caucasus, with a historically mixed population of Abkhaz, Russians, Armenians, Georgians, Greeks, Turks, Tatars, Ossetians, among many, many others. In the 20th century, this diversity was severely damaged by the Stalinist deportations and later the 1992-93 war and accompanying ethnic cleansing. Today, Abkhazia has largely been forgotten, except when tensions flare up between Russia and Georgia, and journalists have to frantically Google what beef Russia has with the Peach State. We tend to think of cryptozoology today as the domain of your uncle's Facebook posts and self-hosted sighting blogs, but it wasn't always this way. In the West, it definitely was. The search for cryptids was never taken seriously by the upper echelons of North American or Western European academia, but in China and the Soviet Union, the search for the Yeti was taken seriously by not only academics, but by the communist political establishment as well. In the 1950s and 60s in China, formal research began into the existence of the Yeren, the Chinese equivalent of the Yeti. Pressure from Mao's government to drop all notions of anything folkloric or superstitious, because that was old culture, suppressed this research, but after Mao's death there was an explosion in interest in Chinese cryptozoology. The government and scientific academies funded numerous major expeditions deep into the mountains to try to find the Yeren. They never found it. A 1977 expedition concluded after much study that the Yeren probably didn't exist, but merely considering that it could, and sending out open-minded scientists to search, ready to conclude yes or no, was more legitimacy than similar ideas had in the West. In the Soviet Union, which always had an unusual relationship with science, cryptozoology was not embraced quite as intensely as in China. However, a lot of serious Soviet scientists dabbled in it, alongside their mainstream fields of history, anthropology, biology, and zoology. Boris Porshnev was one such academic, and he became obsessed with the idea of relict hominids, the idea that in some remote areas of the world there are surviving non-Homo sapiens sapiens hominins. Porshnev in particular believed that there were still Neanderthals out there, and this brought him into the circle of Bernard Heuvelmans, probably the most influential cryptozoologist in the Western Bloc. Together they published a book, L'homme de Néandertal est toujours vivant, or Neanderthal Man is Still Alive. It's what it says on the tin. They point to Zana as their core example, arguing she was a relic Neanderthal. Bernard Heuvelmans is a fascinating character in his own right. He never intended to be relegated to the fringes. He had a genuine, legitimate doctorate in zoology from the Free University of Brussels, and intended to establish a new subfield of zoology, which an associate of his named cryptozoology, the study of yet unknown animal species. Zoologists discover new species all the time. What Heuvelmans saw himself doing was exploring where new species could potentially come from. In the 1930s, the coelacanth, an ancient fish representing a transitional stage between amphibians and modern fish, was discovered to still be alive in the Indian Ocean, relatively common, known about by local fishermen but not the scientific community. Giant squid weren't photographed alive until the 21st century, and their cousin the colossal squid, which is actually not as long as a giant squid but much stouter and heavier, wasn't even confirmed to be a real creature until the 1980s, although the first evidence of it surfaced in the 1920s. And giant squid closely resemble classic sea monsters of folklore. The story of the Kraken probably really does come from some Viking's encounter with a giant squid at some point. Was it any crazier to claim that there was a shy, undiscovered great ape species similarly responsible for Yeti or Bigfoot stories? Take the example of pandas. Pandas are so shy and elusive, they aren't described once in ancient Chinese sources. There are a few ancient texts that sort of sound like they're talking about pandas, but most scholars think they mean other mammals, like snow leopards, Malayan tapirs, and even entirely fictional creatures. The word panda comes from the red panda, which is more closely related to raccoons and weasels than it is to the giant panda, which is a bear. Giant pandas, which are what you think of now when you think of pandas, were first named and described by Westerners, and the Mandarin word for them, xiongmao, bear cat, first came into use in the 19th century. And in the same mountains, not too far away from where pandas were discovered, so say the villagers, there lived the Yeren. Thinking about it that way, wouldn't you organize a search party to go find the Yeren? Hovelmans, like the cryptozoologists he influenced in the USSR and China, was deeply committed to the scientific method. In the traditions he spawned, outright fabrication of evidence seems to be rare. Rather, they use real materials and methods and simply misconstrue them as far as humanly or inhumanly possible. Over the course of his life, Hovelmans gradually drifted further towards fringe science because that was the only place his theories were accepted in the West, but he resented being tarred as a crackpot. He would regularly conclude that a particular cryptid didn't exist after all and move on to investigating another. Hovelmans type cryptozoologists aren't particularly conspiratorial either. They believe in the veracity of mainstream science and just desperately want to be included. Their search for evidence is based in a sincere desire to prove their theories and finally gain recognition within mainstream academia. So, who or what was Zana? As mentioned before, research into Zana's story began in the 1950s, with Mashtovtsev and Porshnev's expedition to collect local accounts of her. Zana became as much a curiosity in death as she was in life. Cryptozoologists studied her as one of the best examples of a real Almasti or Neanderthal. Unlike most other individual cryptids, there are hundreds of local accounts corroborating her existence. Sure, they're contradictory and come from random people 70 years after her death, but there is no question that she really did exist, and was, in some way, really, really weird. The location of her and her children's graves remained elusive, though. No records existed of the precise locations of their burials, and haphazardly digging up cemeteries in search of the Yeti is generally frowned upon. Porshnev began searching for Zana's grave in 1964, accompanied by an archaeologist. He found the Ganaba family cemetery, heavily overgrown and neglected. The grave of Kuit, who had only died 10 years earlier, was the only thing they could easily identify. Igor Burtsev, a protege of Porshnev, exhumed Kuit's skull in 1971, after years of failed attempts to locate Zana herself. He brought the skull to Moscow, where it was examined by anthropologists. Kuit's skull is larger than usual for humans, and it shows some archaic features, which were interpreted by Burtsev and his colleagues as evidence for him being half Neanderthal. Kuit's skull ended up in the collection of Moscow's State Darwin Museum, but it was sold to a private collection when the museum ran out of money. In the 2000s, with DNA tests having become ubiquitous, Oxford geneticist Brian Sykes managed to get his hands on an incisor tooth from Kuit's skull as part of a larger project examining so-called physical evidence of wild men. Although the preservation conditions were not ideal for DNA analysis, Sykes was able to extract mitochondrial DNA information from the tooth. He also tested saliva, collected from 6 known descendants of Zana. The conclusion from these tests was clear. She had not been a Neanderthal or Almasti at all, but a human of sub-Saharan African descent. Specifically, Sykes found that she was 100% African, probably from West Africa. Funnily enough, for some reason in the 2010s, a handful of supposedly reputable newspapers picked this story up and claimed that Sykes had confirmed the possibility of Zana being a Yeti. This significantly damaged Sykes' credibility in academia, despite him having never said anything of the sort. Regardless, this revelation of her being African brings us closer to solving the mystery of Zana, but raises more questions. How did she get to Abkhazia, of all places? Where was she born? And where was her family? Why was she covered in hair? And how did she never learn how to speak? And where was Zana herself buried? Igor Burtsev actually did manage to find Zana's body in the 1980s, although he couldn't prove it at the time. A female skeleton was found in the Ganaba family cemetery, but the grave was unmarked, which led to speculation that this could be Zana. The skeleton wasn't confirmed to be Zana until 2021, when a group of geneticists were finally able to perform DNA tests. They found that the woman was indeed Kuwait's mother, and rather than being West African, she was more likely to be of East African extraction. Given the analysis being more recent and thorough than Sykes' work, I'm inclined to believe that she was indeed of East African descent. The same team speculates that her unusual appearance and behavior could have been from her having congenital generalized hypertrichosis, a rare genetic syndrome which causes excessive hair growth all over the body and face, as well as intellectual disability and facial differences. This is not a happy story. Zana and Kuwait's skulls remain in the collection of Igor Burtsev, separated from their bodies and their homes. But we still remain with a key question. How did Zana, and whatever community she belonged to, end up in Abkhazia? Starting in 1913, Russian newspapers began reporting on a curiosity recently discovered in our favorite exotic corner of the empire, a hitherto unknown community of black Africans in the Caucasus. The first article was published in the Tbilisi-based paper Kavkaz by a Russian scholar who had visited Batumi, a city in present-day southwest Georgia. V.P. Vrady had discovered a black community in the city when he visited in 1912, and he estimated they numbered around 20 to 30 people. His article prompted a number of responses confirming the existence of other small black communities in the area that's now the country of Georgia. Another article, written by one F. Elias for the magazine Argus, estimated 200 to 300 black people in Batumi. Vrady's article in particular stirred up a number of responses from readers which not only confirmed the presence of black people in Batumi, but in small communities all over the Caucasus. Investigation into the enigmatic black Caucasians stopped because of World War I and the Russian Revolution, but they were again discovered in 1923, when journalist Zinaida Richter published an article in the Moscow newspaper Izvestia about her visit to an entirely black village near Sukhumi, the largest city in Abkhazia. It was at this time that Western papers started to pick up on the story, with articles in Opportunity magazine, Abbott's Monthly, and the New York Times, published in the 1920s and early 30s. The New York Times article, by Russian anthropologist Bruno Adler, describes small isolated black villages in Abkhazia. He notes how they refused to intermarry, despite Soviet encouragement to do so. Adler claims he found one man, the oldest in the village, who said he had been brought from Africa as a small child, with a few hundred others. Another account we have is that of Otto Hall, an African-American man who visited the USSR in 1925. After hearing rumors of the black population near Sukhumi, he spent a few weeks there among around 800 black families. He found that they had intermarried substantially with locals, but there was still a small handful of fully African villagers. These early 20th century descriptions of Afro-Abkhaz, as we can see, they vary widely. Sometimes they're unmixed and isolated, sometimes they've been intermarrying with other groups for generations. Vrady describes the black people in Batumi as being mostly Muslim and speaking only Abkhaz. Note that Batumi is not in Abkhazia, implying that this community had migrated together from Abkhazia. He noted that they were locally called Arabs, Lazas, or Adjars, but weren't thought of as Africans. Lazas and Adjars, two ethnic groups native to the Caucasus, both substantially intermarried with the black community, while the Arab designation seems to just denote foreignness rather than actual Arab ethnicity. Some Afro-Abkhaz were more light-skinned and had features more similar to other peoples of the region, while others had darker skin and more prominent African-looking features. Most of them were rural farmers, in some cases living in their own primarily black communities. But where did they come from? Based on his interviews with locals, Vrady concluded that some of them lived there since beyond living memory, but he could not deduce anything more specific than that. Because of the lack of any unified oral tradition or genetic evidence, speculation has swirled among nerds throughout the last 100 years. There are two main theories. In 1913, E. Lavrov wrote a letter in response to Vrady's article on the Black Abkhazians. Lavrov pointed out that in antiquity, the region had been known by the Greeks as Colchis. This polity, Colchis, is pretty mysterious and mostly known from Greco-Roman, Armenian, and Assyrian sources. It existed in some form from around the 13th century BCE to 131 Common Era and stretched along the Black Sea coast from what is now northeastern Turkey to Abkhazia. The ethnic identity of the Colchians is debated, with many considering them to have been the ancestors of modern Mingrelian and Laz people, ethnic groups closely related to Georgians. However, the evidence for this is somewhat tentative, and other scholars have argued against any certain ethnic identification. Greek was widely spoken, and some Colchian burials have people's names coming from a wide variety of origins. Herodotus, the famous 5th century BCE Greek historian, wrote that the Colchians have dark skin and, quote, woolly hair, and speculated that they come from Egypt originally. You may see where this is going. Lavrov proposed that the Black Abkhazians were a remnant of the ancient Colchians, who had survived thousands of years of migration and conquest in the region. Patrick English, in a 1959 article on the matter for the Journal of Near Eastern Studies, supported this hypothesis. He pointed to Herodotus's note that the Colchians wove linen in the same way as the Egyptians. On this basis, Herodotus had concluded that Sesostris, a legendary Egyptian king, had left part of his army in the Caucasus while returning from his conquests of Europe. English also discussed apparent linguistic connections between Abkhaz and Bantu languages, speculating that the word Abkhaz had originally come from the Bantu prefix Aba and the hypothetical original name for the people, Khaz. He connects this unattested name Khaz to Kash, a group of people northeast of Anatolia who often warred with the Hittites. He further connects Greek and Egyptian legends of invaders from the south to the pre-Hittite inhabitants of Cappadocia in today's Turkey, therefore explaining apparently Bantu-sounding elements of the Proto-Hittite language. One of English's weirder claims relates to the Khazars, a nomadic Turkic people who established a huge empire in the North Caucasus and other parts of what's now Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan in the early Middle Ages. A Muslim historian, Istakhri, wrote in the 10th century that the Khazars had dark skin, likening them to Indians. English, however, is skeptical that the Khazars could have been of Indian origin owing to the great distance between India and the Khazar Khaganate, and points to the dark-skinned Abkhazians just south of the Caucasus Mountains as a possible origin for the Khazars. The long and short of Patrick English's thesis is that the Black Abkhazians were a remnant of the ancient Colchians, themselves of African origin, and that there was some sort of influence from people who lived in the vicinity of the Hittites, and that some group of them later became the Khazars. If you're somewhat skeptical about this theory, that's reasonable. Many of English's claims require more than just a small leap of faith. Few, if any, people promote the Colchis theory today, as the fields of archaeology, genetics, and historical linguistics have advanced beyond much of its evidence. Today, the preeminent explanation for the existence of Black Abkhazians is slavery. The Black Sea was a major hub for the Afro-Eurasian slave trade from antiquity until the 19th century, and the Caucasus was very much part of it. So the theory goes that starting around the 16th century, the Ottomans brought people from East Africa, their main source of African slaves for the Ottoman trade, across the Black Sea and sold them to Abkhazian nobility. African slaves were particularly prized by the elite of the Black Sea Rim, where they were viewed as exotic status symbols. When Ottoman presence waned as the Russians asserted dominance, at least some of those slaves were freed and integrated themselves into Abkhaz society. Lily Goldenhanga, a Soviet scholar of African-American origin, supported this conclusion when she investigated the matter in the 1960s. Now, there's a bit of an issue with this theory, despite it being pretty logical. There's no hard specific evidence for it. In general, the North Caucasus was a source of slaves rather than a destination, with Circassians, who are related to the Abkhaz, being especially targeted to bring back to the Ottoman court. The Ottoman system of slavery didn't designate particular ethnicities as particularly suited to slavery, other than perhaps the Circassians, who fetched twice the price of other slaves. To this day, the Circassians' main claim to fame as a people is how the Ottomans thought they were the most beautiful people in the world, and accordingly constantly kidnapped them to be concubines. There's no clear census of what percentage of enslaved Ottomans came from which places, but an analysis of the slaves brought to Aleppo in today's Syria in the late 17th century estimates that a third of them were Georgian, so non-African people from the Caucasus, another third were Russian, and the remaining third consisted of people from the Balkans, Greece, and yes, Africans, but Africans were never that common. The Caucasus was the untamed frontier of the empire, which is why the Ottomans sent slave raids there. It was far more likely for slaves to come out of the Caucasus than to ever go back there. Patrick English pointed this out when arguing for the Colchian origin. The slavery explanation is just conjecture and doesn't entirely line up with what we know about the slave trade in the Caucasus generally. However, there are verified examples of African slaves being brought to the Caucasus, such as a man named Bashir Shamba, who was purchased by a Georgian prince and accompanied the prince on his military campaigns. Slava Tynes, a black Russian journalist who investigated the Afro-Abkhaz in the 1970s, corroborated English's basic claim of an ancient origin through the work of 19th century Abkhaz linguist and ethnographer Dmitry Gulia. Gulia, who believed the Colchians had an Egyptian origin, demonstrated a number of similarities between Abkhaz and Egyptian place names, and parallels between religion and culture. Realistically, this is probably a coincidence, but it is interesting. More compelling, though, is that Gulia also found clear references to Africans in ancient Abkhaz legends. In the Narts, a North Caucasian set of epic tales shared by the Abkhaz and a number of other ethnic groups, the heroes travel to a place that certainly seems to be describing sub-Saharan Africa, and are welcomed by black-skinned people. Some of them return with the protagonists to the Caucasus to see how they live, and many of them decide to stay. The Narts are thought to be thousands of years old, and the Abkhaz version is considered particularly archaic. It's totally possible that this tale was composed to explain the presence of African-descended people at some point in the distant past. Tynes himself visited Adjoubja, the most well-known Afro-Abkhaz village, and met the Abash family. The Abashes said they were descended from slaves brought from Turkey and purchased by a local prince Abashidze, hence their name. Tynes also talked to Abkhaz scholar Viano Pachulia, who had done ethnographic fieldwork among Afro-Abkhaz elders. All of them knew they had originated from Africa, but couldn't identify where, and all of them believed their families had always been respected members of the community. No folk memory of slavery existed among them, which you would expect if it had only been a few hundred years since they first arrived. Furthermore, one old man, interviewed by Vradi, remembered that black families had voluntarily moved into Abkhazia under Ottoman rule. According to Otto Hall, one village elder told him that they had originally been Numidian mercenaries of the Ottomans and deserted the military in Abkhazia after conducting raids in the region. They decided to settle there and became integrated into the already diverse Abkhazia. They later served with the Cossacks in the Russian Imperial Army. Yet another theory, expressed by prominent Moscow anthropologist Sergei Arutyunov, posits that a ship in the 18th century headed from Turkey to Crimea wrecked off the Abkhazian coast. The ship was carrying slaves from East Africa, and when those on board were rescued by locals and Russian soldiers, they were freed and settled in Abkhazia. The lack of strong documentary or archaeological evidence for any of these theories forces us to triangulate what sounds most likely, which seems to be a combination of an older existing population, slavery, and voluntary settlement. The evidence we do have is mixed. There's enough pieces pointing to both older and newer origins that both are plausible. Sometimes the evidence even contradicts itself. The people Pachulia talked to had no memory of slavery, while the Abashes firmly held on to the slavery origin story. My theory is something along the lines of this. For thousands of years, there's been an African-looking population scattered across the Caucasus in a few places. Maybe they came directly from Africa in some deeply ancient migration long forgotten to history. Maybe, like the Andamanese or Aboriginal Australians, they developed black skin and Afro-textured hair through convergent evolution, although that also probably points to an origin somewhere hotter than the Caucasus. Either way, they ended up being seen as Africans, both by the Ottomans and eventually by themselves as well, and when the Ottomans freed their African slaves, as they did for most of their slaves, most people enslaved under the Ottoman Empire eventually died free, they would be sent to the Caucasus. A bit like freed American slaves going to Liberia, since the Ottomans knew there were fellow Africans in the Caucasus. That's just my hypothesis. It ties up the contradictions, but it remains to be proven, as the scant bits of oral history and speculation are really all we have for now. Mm-hmm. Russia is not somewhere we typically associate with a vibrant black community, but there was one point amid the Cold War when that seemed like it could change, as the Black Power movement was growing, and many black Americans were feeling that the classic civil rights movement had stalled. The USSR sent out its feelers, eager to be perceived as the liberator of oppressed peoples. The singer and actor Paul Robeson testified before Congress that, "In Russia, it was the first time I felt like a human being." The Cold War was a forgotten but extremely important element of the 60s civil rights movement in the US. America's treatment of its black population had been a common theme in Soviet propaganda from the very start, and plenty of Americans acknowledged that they had a point. One of the main things that motivated Congress to support the Civil Rights Act in 1964 was to defang the Soviets' claims of being the true land of freedom. Of course, the reality of ethnicity and race in the USSR was not all that, but compared to the freshly post-Jim Crow USA, it may have seemed nice. Most people in major Soviet cities had never met a black person before. Far better to be treated as a fascinating foreign curiosity than to be known and hated. And there were a few existing connections. The aforementioned Lily Goldenhaga was undoubtedly the most prominent figure in connecting Russia and black Americans. She was born in the Uzbek SSR, today's Uzbekistan, to American parents who had left the US to get married, as her mother was white and her father was black. Lily Golden became a scholar of African studies in the USSR and personally investigated the Afro-Abkhaz. Slava Tynes, the son of George Tynes, another one of the handful of black Americans who had fled to the USSR, also wrote about the Afro-Abkhaz. In the 60s and 70s, the Soviets often used the Afro-Abkhaz, among other minority communities in the USSR, as a token of their commitment to racial harmony and equality. Tynes' articles, published in a black American newspaper, firmly fit into this moment in time. According to Tynes' account, the Abashas worked on the tea and citrus plantations on equal footing with the other Abkhaz peasants, without racial animus. One of them, Shaban Abash, even became a celebrated soldier in the Circassian Cavalry Regiment in World War I. Tynes interviewed Nutsa Abash, a locally prominent gynecologist, and several of her cousins. The picture he paints is pretty idyllic, clearly pointing towards the Soviet image of intermarriage and eventually assimilation. The new Soviet man simply didn't see color. Nutsa Abash had written a short article titled In Defense of My Sisters for the official Soviet newspaper of record, Pravda, in 1963, in which she said, "It hurts me to think about the fate of the Negroes in America, not only because I've been brought up in the spirit of humanism and proletarian internationalism, but also because my skin is the same color as my sisters in America." In the last century, at the whim of the Georgian prince Abashidze, a group of Negroes was brought to Abkhazia from Africa. For many years, they were deprived of all rights and bore the yoke of slavery. But then the October Revolution arrived in Abkhazia, and today the descendants of the Negroes delivered here from Africa live freely and happily among Abkhazians, Georgians, and Russians. I was born during the Soviet era, and neither I nor any of my relatives have ever in our lives encountered even a hint of what might be called discrimination. I, like everyone in our country, received a free higher education. Recently, I was appointed the head doctor of a district hospital. Nutsa's account, which may be true or may be embellished to some degree, a constant across history is that no media source with truth in its name can be trusted, is reflective of the way the Soviets tried to encourage ethnic splits and divisions in the US, which ultimately weren't that successful. The majority of the leftist movements that sprung up in 1960s America were just as against the USSR as they were against the US. But also, since this article was written in Russian for Russians, this shows that the Soviets also tried to teach their own citizens that Russia is a melting pot, that this country too is diverse and multicultural, something that has definitely always been true but was not a self-identity Russia had before the revolution. The US tried to hit the USSR back over their treatment of Jews, and as you're about to learn, the USSR had an intriguing response. Soviet policies toward managing their multi-ethnic empire were a mixed bag. Regional languages and cultures were promoted and encouraged if they had a republic of their own. So the Uzbek SSR was supposed to speak Uzbek and be an Uzbek nation within the USSR. The Georgian SSR was supposed to speak Georgian and be a Georgian nation within the USSR, etc. But if you were an ethnic minority within one of the non-Russian-speaking republics, you'd be encouraged to assimilate with the Uzbeks or Georgians, or put on a train and sent to a collective farm or factory thousands of miles away, in what was supposedly a designated homeland for your people. In some cases, republics that had their own official language and nationhood were deliberately diluted with mass migration of ethnic Russians, if the Politburo thought the republic was especially likely to rebel. This notably happened in the Baltics. But some minorities were held up as examples to the world. An interesting earlier corollary to the use of the Afro-Abkhaz as a symbol of Soviet tolerance was Lenin's designation of a Jewish autonomous oblast way out in Siberia. Jews were never forcibly moved there, unlike many other ethnic minorities who were shuffled around across the largest nation-state to ever exist, but for decades, the USSR did aggressive PR campaigns to promote Jewish settlement in the autonomous oblast. Jews never reached more than 25% of the population of the oblast, and when the USSR collapsed, almost the entire Jewish population left for Israel. The Jewish Autonomous Oblast still exists as part of the Russian Federation, and is the world's only other officially Jewish state, despite now being only about 2% Jewish. The short answer? We don't know. The Afro-Abkhazian community has disappeared. The last detailed sighting, so to speak, was Slava Tynes in 1973, as far as I know. One theory, bolstered by accounts from Joseph Stalin's daughter, of all people, is that the Afro-Abkhaz fell victim to the mass deportations in the Caucasus of the 1930s and 40s. Svetlana Alyuleva, who had defected from the Soviet Union and moved to the US, wrote in her 1969 memoir, Only One Year, that someone she called Bertha, probably a pseudonym for Lily Golden, had confided to her about the dire circumstances of the Afro-Abkhaz. Bertha had told Alyuleva that when she had visited Abkhazia, she had witnessed black Muslim Abkhaz living in extreme poverty and mostly illiterate. She couldn't speak to them directly since they knew no Russian, but talking through interpreters, she learned that they were afraid her presence signaled that they would be transported somewhere far away. Golden likely would have visited Abkhazia in the late 50s or early 60s, only a few years after the end of Stalin's deportations from the Caucasus. The deportations had mainly targeted Chechens and Ingush, whom Stalin, himself from Georgia and head of the NKVD Lavrenty Beria, personally viewed as Nazi collaborators. They also haphazardly deported scores of other ethnic minorities. One of the actions taken during de-Stalinization was to return those deported out of the Caucasus to their homelands, although during that time much of the land had been settled by other ethnic groups. Naturally, this produced ethnic tensions which persist today to varying degrees. Either way, the fear allegedly displayed by the Afro-Abkhaz toward outsiders could indicate that they had been previously deported or threatened with it. However, we should remember that this comes from Stalin's own daughter and not Golden directly. It's possible that Alyuleva could have been embellishing or have mistransmitted some information. Although I can't access the short book she wrote on the topic of Africans in Russia, Lily Golden gave a short account of the current state of affairs for the Afro-Abkhaz in the 1960s. She claimed that most of the descendants of Afro-Abkhaz were living in Azerbaijan and Crimea, and that only a few hundred remained in Abkhazia, another potential indicator of them being deported or encouraged to migrate. But she only went into detail about those handful of Afro-Abkhaz living in the Sukhumi area, like the Abashes, rather than the apparent majority of them living elsewhere, including in the Abkhazian hinterlands. The exact reason for this is unclear, but given the Soviet penchant for censorship and the book being published for a foreign audience, I think we can draw our own conclusions. Soviet Russian and Abkhazian writer Fazil Iskandar repopularized the topic to some degree with a short story published in 1989, but no new scholarly investigation resulted from that. They next pop up in the 1992-93 Abkhazia War, which was a brutal and horrific conflict characterized by mass atrocities from both the Georgian military and Abkhaz rebel forces. During the siege of Tvarcheli, the three villages which reportedly still had Afro-Abkhaz communities, Adjubja, Kindig, and Tomsh, were destroyed by the Georgian military. The fate of those Afro-Abkhaz is still not known, but it seems certain that the war destroyed any semblance of a community that remained after all those years. We started out talking about cryptids, and in a sense that's where we end, too. Like Bernard Hovelmans, we're dealing in second-hand reports of sightings, allegations that maybe in this or that far-flung area, these people might survive. Trying to remain as scientific as we can, but ultimately everything here rests on hearsay. That the Afro-Abkhaz existed once is certain. That they still have descendants out there, somewhere in the ruins of the Soviet Empire, is also almost certain. The Caucasus remains a place of ethnic instability. Just a few years ago, Artsakh, a majority Armenian breakaway state from Azerbaijan, had its entire population emptied into Armenia by the Azeri military. The cycle continues. Navigating this mess of countries and partially recognized pseudo-countries is impossible without a heavy-duty diplomatic passport, and even then, I'd be hesitant to cobble together a search party to go find the last Afro-Abkhazians. Can't say I'd like to go look for them in Crimea, either. If we can draw a hypothesis about Zana at all, it seems plausible she was born to an Afro-Abkhaz family. Her disability and unusual appearance may have been interpreted as a curse, and resulted in her being abandoned in the mountains, something widely documented in lots of societies across the world, or she may have simply gotten lost and was never found by her family. Perhaps she learned to survive in the wilderness, where her appearance helped her camouflage instead of drawing attention to her. Until it didn't. If the Afro-Abkhazians really did arrive as Ottoman slaves, then they were only there for a few hundred years, just one fleeting chapter in the long story of ethnic ferment in the Caucasus. But I doubt they're gone, or all scattered beyond their old homeland. In a place so thoroughly on the edges of the world, time passes slowly. Speaking of Jewish autonomous communities, another fascinating relict ethnic group in the Caucasus are the Mountain Jews, who speak their own language similar to Farsi, and live in a single town in Azerbaijan, sometimes considered the last shtetl. The Afro-Abkhazians are out there too. If they were in a more peaceful part of the world, we'd already know for sure where they came from, and where they went. But things disappear in the Caucasus. And if the Afro-Abkhazians are there, well, maybe, just a little ways further up the mountains, there lives the Almasti.
Want to-